I'll begin today with the father's lament. Actually, it's parents' lament, but it's the original father who laments. So whenever your children are out of control, you can take comfort from the thought that even God's omnipotence did not extend to his own children. After creating heaven and earth, God created Adam and Eve, and the first thing he said was, "Don't." "Don't what?" Adam replied. "Don't eat the forbidden fruit," God said. "Forbidden fruit? We have forbidden fruit. Hey, Eve, we've got forbidden fruit." "No way." "Yes way." "Do not eat the fruit," said the father. "Why?" "Because I'm your father and I said so," God replied, beginning to wonder why he had not stopped creating after making tigers. A few minutes later, God saw his children having an apple break. "Didn't I tell you not to eat the fruit?" God, as our first parent, asked. "Uh-huh," Adam replied. "Then why did you?" said the father. "I don't know," said Eve. "She started it," said Adam. "Did not, did to, did not." Having had it with the two of them, God's punishment was that Adam and Eve would have children of their own. They needed to start off a little light, because the next chapter in the act of God's covenant with mankind gets ugly, and it gets ugly fast. We review from last week that, if I can go forward, that the covenant of Eden was that God created in order to continue to be what? To be love. In order to love, he needed, quote unquote, or he placed himself in a position to need to create in order to love. Humankind, humanity, lives to choose to love and live in what? Eden means what? Luxury, to live in luxury. God weaved himself into the DNA of humanity. He created them in his image. He gave each of them someone else to love besides himself. And in doing so, he completed his presence in creation. This is the only time that he ever pronounced it very good. You and me and you, and he and us. That's the only time God says, "All right, we got it. This is what I wanted." And that he entered into our story then. God enters into our history and our present and our future. As I pointed out last week, love begins with one thing. What does it begin with? It begins with a choice. It begins with free will. We only exist to govern and to rule and to create in the love that was given to us, that we were freely to choose, that God created us in his image. We get the same. So remember the truth of how the choice was made known. Do we remember? Just to look real quick, because this is where it will take place. The Lord God commanded the man, "You may eat freely of every tree of the garden, but of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat, for in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely what? You shall surely die." How did we know they had a choice? There were two trees. Even if there maybe technically wasn't two physical trees, the choice exists between life and what? Death. What is the only way to live? What is the only path to life? It's God himself. He is life. He gives life. He sustains life. It's not just that we got here based on creation, but we are here because of his willingness to continue to sustain our life. Imagine being in charge of every human's every heartbeat and every breath. It's the only reason we're sitting here right now. Heart still beating, lungs still breathing. The knowledge of good and evil, the choice between life and death. The next chapter of the covenant takes place right here. This is the scene. This is the scenery on the stage of the great controversy. It's here. On earth, it's at the tree. Here it is. covenant moves on. The serpent was more crafty, so the scene begins, as many plays do, a new center of the stage, and we're introduced to a new what? To a new character. Up until this time, we don't know who he is. Adam and Eve certainly don't know who he is, except that he is where? He's there, apparently. He was more crafty than any other wild animal that the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, "Did God say you shall not eat from any?" Did he say that you shall not eat from any tree in the garden? The woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, you shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you what? Nor shall you touch it, or you shall die." She had it right, didn't she? She had it right. She was doctrinally pure. In fact, her doctrine was even sound. She even added a little bit. She didn't quote exactly what God had said. God said, don't eat of it. She said, don't what? Don't even touch it. That's pretty cool to know that you have the wisdom to say, you know what? If I don't touch it, I can't what? I can't eat it. So that's pretty cool. But she's doctrinally pure, isn't she? She has the right doctrine. She has the right words. But where will doctrinal purity, church, get you without love and without trust? We'll see where it'll get us. Because after he gets her to do just that, after Satan gets her to at least just kind of question, this character will show his new colors. The serpent said to the woman, "You won't what? You won't die. For God knows that when you eat it, your eyes will be opened. You shall be like God, knowing what? Knowing good and evil." You won't die. He's just telling you that. Because when you do, you will become like him, and he knows it. And that's what he doesn't want. He doesn't want you to be like him. That's a pretty good argument for someone who feels perfect in her beauty at the moment. Pretty good argument for two creatures that are absolutely perfect in their creation right up until this moment. You have life, God said. Trust that. That's what I want you to trust. Does it mean you can't trust your beauty and your wisdom? God would say, no, I gave you your beauty and your wisdom. Just don't begin to count on your beauty and your wisdom for what? For life. It's interesting. First, the serpent lied, and then he what? And then he told the truth. We call him the father of lies. But it isn't true, is it? The serpent doesn't always lie. Sometimes he tells the truth. But he tells the truth for his own purpose. When it serves his purpose, he will tell the truth. See, he told the truth there, didn't he? In fact, he almost echoes God's words. For God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil. God has already told them that he's like who? That they're like who? That they're like him. He's already told you that. She knows. Wait a minute. I don't have to eat this to be like God. Because he told me that I'm already what? I'm already like him. I'm created in his image. The covenant was just asking the humans, the brand new children of God, to what? To trust that. Trust me for life. When it comes to life and death and you want to make a decision, trust it. We have a future holder of the covenant that will tell Israel, "Today I stand before you between life and death. Guess what? I'd choose life if I were you." Trust me, he says. But she made her decision. The woman saw that the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, that the tree was desired to make one what? To make one wise. She took of its fruit and ate. She also gave some to her husband who was with her, and he what? And he ate. Notice she saw. Her wisdom leads her to believe she can make the decision now. I've been given life. I've been told how to live it. I need to trust that, but this looks good. Was there any reason to believe that the tree didn't look good? No. No reason at all. It did look good. It's not about the fruit, is it? It's about the decision. It's about who to trust in this particular situation. So she chooses another role. A role that at least up until this moment is only reserved for who? It's only reserved for the Creator. Up until this moment, it's His. And the role then to usurp that is no longer based on faith. It's no longer believing God when He said, I've given you this, it's a gift, it's yours. Just what? In essence, the Edenic covenant is, I create, I give life, you live. Period. Done. The evidence of life was all around. All he asked was for them to trust that, to trust him. So we need to get this before we move on in this particular drama, if you will, this act of this play that you could call the great controversy, that you could call the covenant of God with his children. We need to get this. The first sin was not disobedience to God's law. The first sin was mistrust. The very first sin was no faith, no longer trusting, no longer believing. Disobedience is the fruit of that sin. You with me? Hope so, because I'm going to say that a whole bunch of times from here on out. The original sin is not what? It is not disobedience. It's mistrust. It's no longer trusting the Creator for what the Creator is there to do, and that is to continue to create life in you. And it has immediate consequences. Something happens immediately. Remember I told you before that in Hebrew thought, quite often, in fact usually always, you see the action of what takes place, and then maybe later an author will put a word to it. So we know this, we call this the original what? The original sin, right? I told you, the word sin is not going to occur for another 3-4 chapters down the road. But Hebrew thought gives you the action. And the action here is extremely disturbing and telling and vivid as to what happens. Because immediately after acting on their decision of unfaithfulness, after no longer believing in God, it says that their eyes were immediately what? Both opened. And they knew they were what? Naked. Now let me ask you this. Were they walking around up until this moment with their eyes closed? No. They're not talking figuratively, are we? No. There was something that they now realize. Seeing becomes a metaphor for realization, right? They now realize something. Immediately they realize that they're what? That they're naked. And they act now on that realization. They act on it. They sew fig leaves together. They make loincloths for themselves. And the words there used are very purposeful. Does a loincloth completely cover you? This isn't a robe. Excuse me. It's not a coat. It's not a suit. It's a what? It's like loincloth. They're naked, and they know they are. So something has happened to them, and they may not yet realize it. But it's clear to us. It's clear to us by their actions what has happened. We don't know when Moses will put a word to this. We don't know if there is a Hebrew word or an English word to be able to put as to what this actually is. But we certainly know their actions. Immediately, it says their eyes were opened and they realized something. They saw that they're what? That they were naked. That they were absolutely vulnerable now. Is there any a time that you're ever more vulnerable than when you're naked? I hate to bring this up on Sabbath. Yeah, I'm just saying this. Why are a lot of our nightmares seem to be predicated on the fact that we are naked in a place that we shouldn't be what? Now, we shouldn't be. How many people have the naked dream every now and then? Right? I'll tell you one thing that he's done for me, he's done a very good thing for me, is that he's never given me the naked dream while I'm standing here. 40 years I haven't had it while preaching, I'm just saying. I think he knows it would kill me. It would absolutely kill me. Okay. But nakedness is not just physical nakedness, which I believe it is at this particular moment, but it also is what? It's also absolute pure vulnerability. Before then, before this thing happened, before this realization happened, their nakedness was not a problem, was it? Wasn't a problem with either of them. They were naked and they felt what? They felt safe. Were they safe or was it just an illusion? Oh, they were safe. They were absolutely safe. Because at the moment, their natures, if you will, what they were created with, clothed their nakedness from being realized. Is what I'm saying is that their nakedness and their vulnerability is now what they have to be tested. They no longer feel what? They no longer feel safe. They were completely safe in God. God told them one thing. They did the opposite and not trust Him. So now they realize something. Am I still safe with Him? What's the answer? They don't think so. By the way, they clothe each other, which means not only are they not going to trust God again with safety, they no longer trust who? They no longer trust each other with their safety. I'm going to talk a lot about this in the next few weeks. But their nature has changed. Something's happened to them. We see the actions of their nature changing. By the way, every human being that's ever been created, we know what their nature is by what? By observing. We see what can happen. You know what my nature is. All you have to do is pay attention to me for a little while. Just observe me for a little while. Paul put it this way. He says, mouths confess what the heart believes. Their nature has changed, which has given these actions now. Something's happened to their safety. I'll put it this way between the two of them. I think that Eve doesn't understand what that look is in Adam's eye right now. She's never seen it before. Adam doesn't understand what this feeling is. She doesn't understand why Eve is looking at him this way. Nature changes everything. How they feel about God, all the way down to how they feel about each other. The next verses describe their actions toward God, how they feel about God. They heard the sound of the Lord God walking in the garden at the time of the evening breeze. And the man and his wife hid themselves from the presence of the Lord God among the trees of the garden. So the loincloths aren't enough. I kind of like to think they put the loincloths on, and since that doesn't help them, it doesn't help them feel any safe with each other, when they hear God coming, they need more cover. So what do? They back into the bushes. We need even more protection from Him. Two things here. One is, do they still need Him for life? And by the way, up until this moment right here, just walking in the garden. How do I put this? Okay, so you answered right. They need him for life. Okay? Has he taken their life away? No. So the covenant, is it still intact? Yes, it's still intact. He's just walking, which apparently he had done before. Okay? So they can't stand now for some reason to be in his presence. They are doing all they can to hide from him. They are doing all they can to run from him. And the horrible tragedy about all this is that now they need him more than ever. And they can't what? And they can't stand him. Do they need him more now than they needed him yesterday? Well, technically, no. But now, yes, right? And they can't stand to be in his presence. If you just want to base actions versus terms, actions first, how you identify something, we've been running from him ever since. This is the definition of original sin. How do I know? It's because my actions in my life have been the same as my original mother and father. And if you're honest with yourself, you know that's true too, don't you? But the second thing that you get to know just from this one verse right here is that you get to find out what God has in mind for what's about to happen. The point is that he's where? Where is he? He's there. Right? We should tell you all you need to know about whether or not the covenant is still intact. What's he there to do? When the Creator shows up somewhere, what is he there to do? He's there to give life. That's what he's there for, all right? So the second is that, hey, wait a minute, hold on. If you want to know what God has in mind for them right now, he's just told you what he has in mind. He still has the covenant intact. He showed up. He showed up today the same way that he showed up yesterday. So as far as the covenant is concerned, who's changed here? Only one party of the covenant has changed. That's real important for the God part of the covenant to still be intact because it was God that gave the covenant. If one of them was to break it, okay, if one of them has to break it, let it be the human one that's got to break it. You don't want God to break it. Right? But he's there. I have to tell you, as a literary gimmick or as a literary revelation, I think Moses is genius here, that he doesn't tell you about this walking, talking presence until after they need it. Up until that moment, he's saying, look, we're still living, so God is still present with this. But this particular pointing out that he's walking in the cool of the evening, okay, talking about how every evening, you know, evenings at this time that happens, I think that after the fall is the time that Moses, he waits to tell because it's now when humanity needs him the most. So God, I believe that Moses waited until after the fall, to tell you about this walking, talking presence of God. I believe it's there so we can still have a glimpse on our side of the fall. Our thousands of years of history and later of living in this fallenness. I believe that it's there so that we could still have the same glimpse of his grace and his love that Adam and Eve had that day. Then the next three words of the verse tell you more about God than maybe hundreds of passages that you would ever use to be able to describe him. But the Lord God called out to the man and said, what? Where are you? This is the longing of the covenant. This tells you the next thing about the covenant. is that even the people that the covenant was made for have now refused it, apparently, are now on their way out as far as the covenant relationship is concerned. But his side of the covenant, there is what? There's still a longing. Where are you? This is the longing of the covenant. The covenant contains that longing. If you think about it, it is what got him here. He's out there in the universe, right? He's just out there, and he longs for something else to happen. He longs for his love to be something else. So it's always been in the covenant. Where are you? Number one, it's a rhetorical question, right? Does he know where they are? This isn't about their location, is it? He knows where they are. Then why say it? Well, number one, he wants them to know that he's what? That he misses them. That he's looking for them. Where are you means, I'm here. Where are you? He wants them to know this longing. And he's able to do it, at least for the moment, without it seeming to be threatening, if you will. Notice he doesn't run right to the bush, grab them by their ear, and pull them out. Where are you is one of the most loving things I've ever heard a father ever say. Where are you? I'm here. Where did you go? I want you here. Yesterday, remember, we were what? We were together. You and me. Something's changed, though. Yesterday, when he showed up, everything was good. It was very good. But something happened, something changed. When he called out to Adam and he said, actually, where are you? Adam then answers, he says, I heard the sound of you in the garden and I was what? And I was afraid because I was naked and I hid myself. Note, not a fear necessarily of God, but a fear of God in relation to his what? And to his nakedness. He said, I heard you were here and I was afraid of you. That isn't what he said, right? I heard you were here, and I was afraid because I was naked. He's not afraid of God, but he's afraid of God in God's relation to his brand new vulnerability. He simply does not trust him anymore. I love how God reacts. Again, he reacts in a very Hebrew way. He reacts in a Hebrew that the Hebrews taught. The rabbis teach not by giving you answers. The rabbis teach by getting you to ask questions. That's how the rabbis teach. So God doesn't come back to tell them exactly what's happened. He doesn't all of a sudden immediately say, well, let me tell you what's going on. He asked Adam a question. Who told you what? Who told you you were naked? Have you eaten from the fruit which I commanded you not to eat? Who told you? Who have you been listening to? Why do you feel you need to be afraid of me right now? Who you been talking to? Have you eaten of the fruit? By the way, what should the answer have been there? Yes. But you don't answer that if you're what? You don't answer that if you're afraid. None of us do. Now, I'm sure, looking at the faces that I see right here, none of you ever lied to your mom and dad about whether or not you did anything. Okay? But you're looking at a face right here who did it many, many times. And the only reason I lied was because I was what? Because I was afraid. If you heard the sound of my dad's voice right now, which I just heard in my ear, you'd understand. Or the sound of your dad's voice, or your mom's, or anybody. And I don't mean to make light of this. I really don't. Because this is all about our parents. This is all about where we came from. This is all about who we've listened to in our lives. This is about every ounce of trauma that has ever been placed upon us. It's done right here, right at the beginning, right with our mom and our dad, our original parents. It happens right here. Who have you been talking to? Who told you you had reason right now to be afraid? That's what this verse tells me. That's what that question tells me. See, even believers, even us, we go back and we look at this story, and I've done it before. That's why I purposely did not ask this question. But there are congregations that I had before that I said, does Adam have a reason to be afraid right now? And every congregation that I asked that, overwhelmingly, they said yes. And God's question then comes back. Who have you been talking to? You're going to teach people that Adam and Eve have a reason to fear me now? Just because they chose not to trust me anymore? Just because they chose not to worship me anymore? Just because they chose another to prostitute themselves with? You think there's a reason that they have to fear me now? Who have you been talking to? And Adam's answer comes back. The man said, what? The woman you gave me. She gave me the fruit from the tree, and I what? And I ate. All the evidence you need right there that Adam's nature is completely what? It's completely changed. Yesterday, there wasn't any other reason, two reasons. There was only 50% of all of Adam's reason for existence was her. Yesterday, 50% of his existence, he lived for her. In one moment after, he's now doing what? He's now blaming her for what? For his actions. Like that, he throws her under the bus. Like that. All for the sake of what? Why does he do it? He does it for nothing, man. Because his fear is what? It's his. Has God given him a reason to fear? I'm with you, man. That's exactly. It's fear. But he does it for nothing. All so that he could look good for God for just one moment? Find somebody to blame? Find a way to justify his actions? Right? That's all he's doing. He's trying to justify what he did by blaming someone else. Just so he could look good for God right there. And also, by the way, so he could get God off his back. It was the woman. And at that moment right there, God understands too. Adam's not going to go where I want him to go. He's made his decision. So God then immediately turns to who? He immediately turns to Eve then. What's this you have done? The woman said what? Serpent tricked me, and I ate. Eve doesn't have anyone else to blame except him. The only other one on the stage. By the way, Adam didn't just blame Eve, he blamed too. He blamed God. The woman tricked me. Oh, by the way, you gave me the woman. It was you. Whew, I'm done, man. Woo. Now I can just go my way. Get out of the face of this guy. What should have been the answer? It should have been the last part of that verse. The serpent tricked me, and I what? And I ate. The answer should have been, Eve, what have you done? I ate. See, but her nature has changed too, hasn't it? She needs a scapegoat. She needs to look good. She doesn't want to be in God's presence any more than Adam does. We need to get out of here. By the way, it's what we all do. It's what we all do. We all think that if we can find someone to blame for our actions, then we are off the hook and we can come out of the bush and we can leave. Why? Because this is our parents. This is who we are. So now we of Western thought, I hear the argument come up now right here at this point in the great controversy. We of Western thought, we have either or'd this to death. Remember I said Western thought, either or. Hebrew thought, what is it? And. It doesn't necessarily need to be either or, new or old. Okay, it's and. It's new and old. Western thought has either or'd what happened here, what's going on here, to death. Okay, and we've done it with God's justice and God's what? And God's mercy. We bring up two things that God is. Is God just? Yes. Is God merciful? Western thought says he either has to be one or the other. Right? He is either merciful or just. He can't be both. Let me tell you this. If only his justice needs to be satisfied at this moment right here, then humanity would never see him again. He told us to trust him for life or there would be consequences. And the consequences would be the opposite of life. What would it be? Death. There, I told him. They chose death. How long do you think it will be before Adam and Eve die if God doesn't return? His justice did not get him to return. As a matter of fact, that would be unjust. They need to suffer their what? They need to suffer their consequences. However, God isn't just. He's what? He's merciful. And God's decided that his mercy is his justice. That's what brings him back. If he was only just, he'd get the telegram, hey, Adam and Eve both ate. And God said, well, I told them. I don't have to go back. I got more important things to do. There's another universe I need to create. See ya. Not only did he return to their walk, he now tells them what it's going to be like. He wants them to know as much about what's going on here as anything else. Right now, at this moment, what do you think Adam and Eve knows about what's going on? Do they realize what's happened? Do they understand? I think that most of the paintings and pictures and everything that you see their shame. You know, you see them hiding, you see their shame and everything else. I don't think it was like that. I think it was just utter confusion. I think it was just absolute astonishment. They got no clue what's happening now. Right? And God not only comes back to tell them that his part of the covenant is still intact. I'm still here. Where are you? Now comes back to say, you know what? I want you to have as much information for what's about to happen that you can possibly have. I want you to have it. I want you to know. That knowledge, that presence still being with him, that desire, that longing for them to have still his presence. So that's what happens next. That's where it goes. Before he begins it, he says, I need you to know one thing. See, he has the three characters on the stage, the three characters that have played in this role right up to this moment. The serpent, Adam, and who? They're all there, okay? He says, I'm going to let you know what's about to happen. I'm going to let you know what these new natures are capable of and what they're about to do. But I have to do something first. He doesn't address Adam. He doesn't address Eve, who's the first one that he speaks to. The Lord said to the serpent, because you've done this, cursed are you. Because you've done this, cursed are you among where? Among all the animals, among all the wild creatures. Upon your belly you shall go, and dust you shall eat of it all the days of your life. He says, here's what you need to know before I tell you one thing about what's about to happen. I need you to know who is cursed, and who is it? It's him. It's the instigator. It's the creator. It's the original creature who made the same decision that Adam and Eve just made. Curses sin for what it does to his creatures, for what it does to his kids. And if nothing else, there's at least a reminder. Because all the serpents ever since then, they all do what? They all crawl. They all slither. I heard a comedian once say, see, that's why you shouldn't like snakes. Look at them. They move around. They got no legs. That's the devil, okay? Like I said, I don't mean to be so lighthearted about it. He's at least saying that creation itself, this creature, is carrying the what? The curse. It's his and his alone. He's the one that they have put their trust in now. They've chosen. They were the king and the queen of this new creation. They ruled this new creation. What they did was they handed their crown to who? They handed their crown to the serpent. They handed their crown to Satan. Which, by the way, in the book of Job, Satan shows up as the ruler of earth. Adam doesn't show up in chapter 1 of Job. The sons of the angels, the sons of God, all show up for a meeting, and Satan strolls in, and God says, who are you? Where did you come from? Satan says, I'm in charge of the earth now. And God's only argument is, well, there's one guy. There's one guy, right? They've given it to him. This ancient son of his, he now carries the curse. But here's what I plan to do. Here's what I'm going to do with the curse. You see it. You see creation carrying the curse. By the way, if you don't want to just look at the serpent, you know, as the symbol of that curse, all you do is look at creation now. Because everything that is created ever since this day all eventually does what now? Everything he creates lives for a while and then what? And then dies. His creation is carrying the curse. Because the covenant was, I create and you what? Live. I create and you live. But now creation carries the curse. Everything it creates what? Dies. So here's what I plan to do, he says. To the original, if you will, the original son who rebelled against his father, who went the other way. He says, I'll put enmity between you and what? And the woman. And between your offspring and hers. He will strike your head and you will what? And you will strike his heel. I already came up with a plan, y'all. I already have a plan in motion. One of these days, this will be made right. One of these days, my creation will live again. One of these days. And it will involve somebody from another world to come in and clean all this up. No, it'll involve who? It'll involve you. Humanity. I'll put enmity between you, the serpent, and whatever entity has inhabited the serpent, I'll take hatred and I'll put it between you and who? And her. The human. The fallen human. Right? And his children and yours. The plan's already in motion. There they are. They're the ones that need a renewal. They need a way back into the living part of the covenant. They've bought the death part, right? They bought the death part, and if God was just, that would be it. They would all simply die. He said, I'm not done yet. Wait a minute. I'm not finished. Love doesn't finish. And I'm not going to bring in some angel, some powerful angel from somewhere else, some unfallen angel to come in and clean this up. The plan that I have for you to be able to move beyond this curse is right here, right now. It's you. See, because the plan is involved with her and her what? and her seed and her offspring and her children. You and me will be right again. The plan is already in motion because she's the first Genesis. They're the first generation. They are it. The first news for the frightened kids is that they're going to give birth one day. There is going to be children one day. The plan will include you even in your fallenness. Even in these very first words, he had no intention of voiding the covenant based on their actions. Should have been a louder amen, I think. I'm going to make you do it. He had no intention of voiding the covenant, even though their actions warranted. It's going to involve you, not right here, you. Okay? And it's that word generations, if you will. You and your new ruler. You, he says, it'll come to an end. One day, this plan will bring you to an end. Hatred, enmity, it's a focused hatred. It's a Hebrew word that focuses your hatred. It's not a general hate, if you will. It's not, I hate Brussels sprouts. It's, I hate you, and I hate you for a reason. There's an enmity to it. One of these days, your new king, if you will, right now, you love him. Right now, you've given yourself to him. Right now, you trust him. One of these days, you won't. But it's interesting. It's not her children. It's not her offspring. Because in the Hebrew, in this particular way, when he says, I'll put enmity between you and the woman, between your offspring and hers, he will strike your head and you will strike his heel. That word offspring is kind of strangled, if you will. It's limited in English, but not in Hebrew. Because in Hebrew, what he really said was, between your offspring, and he used the plural, your children, if you will, speaking to the serpent, and hers. But when he said hers, he used singular, one child. One of these days, there's going to be one of your generations. One of your Genesises, if you will. One of your kids. There'll be one child who will be the epitome, the embodiment of this hatred against the enemy. He will come to do something about the curse. One child. In pronouncing the curse upon the enemy, in pronouncing the curse upon Satan, pronouncing the original breaker of the covenant between creature and creator, in pronouncing the curse on it, he also gives the very first messianic prophecy to our parents. One day, there'll be a baby. One day, there'll be one child who'll carry this enmity. He says, it won't be easy. And how do I know this? Because the very next person that he's going to turn to talk to about this is Eve. And what does he say to her? He says, I will make your pangs in one, childbirth. The covenant is still about who? It's still about humanity. It's still about humans. And when the Messiah comes, he won't just be the Son of God, but he'll be equally the Son of what? Son of Man. Theologians who know them both, who knew both Adams by Scripture. Paul, a rabbi who knew Adam like he knew his own father. Because there he was in the Torah. I know exactly who that is. He calls Jesus the second Adam. The humanity is right there. Could he have brought Messiah from somewhere else? Could he have brought Michael right in and have Michael just clean this all up? Right? He could have. That's right. He could have. But it would violate the what? It'd violate the covenant. I made this covenant with you. And by the way, I made this covenant with you knowing you would break it. I married you knowing you would cheat on me. I am your father. I gave birth to you knowing one day kill me. I made the covenant with you. Nothing's changed. Because I know one day, there'll be a baby. One day there'll be one child that's going to put this all right. And there's a hint in there on how it'll be done, right? He will strike your head. You'll strike his heel. You will have limited success on him. You'll have limited success on him and the rest of humanity. But he will do what to you? He'll kill you. And we know that one day he pronounced the words, "From where are you to it is finished." So we'll spend a few weeks talking about what we did to the covenant and whether or not we really did anything to the covenant. Apparently, it already involved, human membership, right? God put himself in human history. He created us. He put us in human history. He becomes one of us. Son of God, son of man. I mean, it's even so difficult to think about, He said it's going to involve. And then what happens when the human part of it says, "Well, I don't want any part of it"? God says what? "Well, I've got a solution." But the solution still involves you. The covenant still needs to be made right with you. So far, even after the fall, God said, "Nothing's changed as far as I'm concerned." If our sin so destroyed God's love for us, if you've been told at all of his anger or his disappointment or anything that happened on the second day that he showed up, my question for you always is, why then? If your sin, if it destroyed that of God's love for us, then why, oh why, did he show up on the second day after the fall offering the same relationship that he gave them the day before? It's right there. So if we see an angry father here, if we see a disappointed father here, I have one question for you today. Who told you you were naked? Who have you been talking to? Frederick Buechner notes, he said, God asked Adam and Eve two penetrating questions after their first act of disobedience. Where are you? And what is it you have done? Therapists, he remarks, have been asking the same questions ever since. Where are you exposes the present reality. They are hiding. They're naked, ravaged by never before known feelings of guilt and shame. What is it you have done that exposes the past? It's his encounter with Adam and Eve. God set forth the consequences of their behavior and then provides clothing to equip them for the new state that they brought about. They can't go back, but they can move forward in a new way, clothed with new information on how to deal with their trauma and their behavior. God keeps the covenant for him. Like I pointed out before, the confusion, everything that's happening, that's going on. They're hemming and hawing. They're looking at each other. They're pointing fingers. They're blaming each other. What I love about the narrative is that even all this is going on and the confusion is happening, God is there to do something. He's there to act. And what does he do? He said he went over amongst the flock. He pulls out one sheep and he brings it out. And he does what? Slaughters them. And then he what? Clothes them. He doesn't make them consent. He doesn't make them confess. He doesn't ask them to forgive each other. He doesn't do anything. He doesn't make them do any penance. He doesn't do anything like that. Even in the midst of them blaming him and blaming each other and all of this, he goes and does this. He sacrifices this animal, sheds its blood on the ground, brings skins to actually then what? Not loincloths, but what? Cover them, it says. Maybe there was just one moment where the confused creature, king and queen, in the midst of yelling at each other and sniping at each other and wondering what's about to happen, that all of a sudden they said, "Wait a minute, I'm warm. Wait a minute, I'm safe." live out one iota of your actions, before you begin to live out one way that my creation will actually be ruined by all of this, I want you to know that with me, you're safe. And I'm going to long for you up until the day it's over. You're not going to want me, God says to us, right? You're not going to want me. But I'm going to find a way to weave myself in and out. You can trust me that I'm going to do it without manipulating your free will. If you'll trust me. And then one day, the baby will show up. One day he will grow up. And along with "Where are you?" there will be "It is finished." And after a while after that, it'll be "Where are you? It is finished." And then, well done. So like I said, we'll spend a few weeks now on the fall. We'll spend it with sin and sinful nature. And what the scripture in the covenant actually says about it, as opposed to what we have been told. Who told you? That's where the turn will be taken. Covenant hasn't been ruined. The covenant has been introduced to things that their actions will now introduce. One is fear. The other is pain. We'll talk about that as we come. But that's where we'll spend the next couple of weeks. Because on the other side, the next chapter of the covenant itself is going to be with another individual, one of Adam's children, named Noah. And it's going to be, we're going to get there, but I need to talk about sin first before we get there. But we remember, covenant hasn't been ruined by our sin. It's just been introduced to words like fear and pain and mistrust, which is now our natures. It's where we live. It's where we feel the most comfortable. As I pointed out before, you and I, we get to be on this side of it. We get to be on this side of "It is finished." To be able to go back then and look at the covenant. I didn't dig this up. You know, it wasn't my degree in Jewish studies. It wasn't what I know about archaeology or Hebrew or any of the theologians that you and I studied. We didn't dig this up. This is knowing Jesus and giving us his view to go back to the Torah, go back to God's actions to view it. That's the only reason we know what we know about the covenant. We conclude what we conclude. That if we continue to walk and talk with him, this stuff will be revealed to us. So I just thank you for allowing me to just to bring, look what I found. This is what I found. Covenant today. This is what I found